Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will answer the question, what is the value of a liberal arts degree?
These students coming out of college are going into the workforce, and these companies that are wanting to hire them are finding that they lack certain skills that liberal arts students would generally be strong in, like writing, reading comprehension, problem solving. So we find that a lot of liberal arts degrees eventually catch up later in their career.
Then you will hear words and their stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo will tell us some clothing-related American English idioms. We'll find out what's up her sleeve.
To ride someone's coattails is to use your ties to someone else to become successful. Long coattails are no longer common on modern-day clothing, yet the expression is still used today. And saying you are riding someone else's coattails is never a good thing.
And finally, we will present The Making of a Nation. We will tell you about the growing tensions in Europe and Asia that caused sharp debates among Americans during the 1930s. The drums of war were growing louder, but many Americans did not want to listen. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here's Pete Musto.
Some college students may wonder why their school asks them to take a class in philosophy when they are seeking a degree in physics. But studying several different subjects in addition to a student's chosen major is the main idea behind a liberal arts education. Many colleges and universities describe themselves as liberal arts schools. Students at these educational institutions are able to choose the main subject they want to study, such as economics. The school also requires them to take a number of classes in several unrelated subjects, like the arts or languages. This is far different from institutions offering degree programs that directly relate to a specific career or industry. These programs are often just for areas of specialized training, such as business, engineering, or medicine. And students preparing for a career in these fields only take classes that relate to their study program. Critics say liberal arts degrees have less value because they fail to help students find good-paying positions or any job right after college. In fact, information on the pay for some careers seems to support this idea. A company called PayScale studies the amount of money people earn in different careers in the United States. The company found that, on average, recent graduates with liberal arts degrees make less than those with degrees directly related to a specific career. For example, PayScale found the average graduate with a bachelor's degree in petroleum engineering will earn $96,700 a year in the first 5 years of their career. By comparison, the average graduate with a bachelor's degree in history will earn $42,200. Sean Leslie is a senior strategist at PayScale. He says students with more technical training often find good jobs right after college. Employers need workers that have skills with a clear purpose right away. But Leslie adds that liberal arts graduates have skills that are useful in different ways, like working well with others and critical thinking. Graduates with more technical degrees often struggle with such skills. He says their education has taught them to carry out specific jobs, but little else.
These students coming out of college are going into the workforce, and these companies that are wanting to hire them are finding that they lack certain skills that liberal arts students would generally be strong in, like writing, reading comprehension, problem solving. So we find that a lot of liberal arts degrees eventually catch up later in their career.
In fact, while PayScale reports lower earnings for liberal arts graduates early in their careers, this changes after several years. For example, the average graduate with a bachelor's degree in government and politics will earn $44,600 per year in the first 5 years after completing their studies. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here's Ana Mateo.
Hello, and welcome to Words and Their Stories from the Voice of America. This program helps you understand common expressions in the English language. You know, we tailor this show for people interested in learning English. Words and Their Stories is tailored to fit people like you. Now, let's say you are a regular listener to the show, and you want to learn the meaning of the saying, to be cut from the same cloth. So you write to us requesting more information. Then I write a show about that expression. You could say that program is tailor-made just for you. A tailor makes men's clothing. When a tailor goes to work, he or she first takes measurements. The tailor then makes clothing for just that individual, not a group of people. We call that kind of clothing tailor-made. They are not mass-produced or sold in stores. The term tailor-made can also be used in other ways. If you are a student and find a class that seems perfect for you, you could say that class is tailor-made for you. But now, let's get back to our earlier expression, to be cut from the same cloth. When making a business suit, a tailor cuts the coat and pant legs from the same piece of cloth. This way, the color and quality of the material match. The same can be said about people. If two people are cut from the same cloth, they are very similar. Let's say Felix and Catherine design video games. The two young designers both want to design good games that help children. They also have the same sense of humor. They have a lot in common. So, you could say they are cut from the same cloth. They are also good friends. So, if Catherine was in need, Felix would give her the shirt off his back. If someone is kind to others and helps those in need, we say that person would give you the shirt off their back. The saying to roll up one's sleeves, however, is not the same as taking off your shirt. It means the person rolling up the shirt sleeves is preparing for some really hard work. Now, we praise people who roll up their sleeves and who give you the shirt off their back. We take our hats off to these people. This means you look up to them and approve of their behavior. Another way of saying this is to tip your hat. In the past, a man would take off his hat to show respect. These days, some men have lost that simple act of civility, or they just don't wear hats. But the expression lives on. I, for example, take my hat off to anyone who helps children. But personally, I don't tip my hat to anyone who rides someone's coattails. To ride someone's coattails is to use your ties to someone else to become successful. Long coattails are no longer common on modern-day clothing, yet the expression is still used today. And saying you are riding someone else's coattails is never a good thing. But now, let's go back to our video game designers, Catherine and Felix. What if Felix designed a game and it became really successful? His career takes off and he becomes famous in the gaming industry. Yet, Catherine's career is far from a success. Her games aren't selling. So she uses her ties to Felix to get more work. People who know them both say she is riding Felix's coattails. But Felix doesn't care. He likes Catherine, and he knows she is using his success to further her career. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. If you have a friend who would like to learn English, tell them to try us on for size. They may find we fit them like a glove. And don't be on pins and needles waiting for the next episode. That will happen next week. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present The Making of a Nation. Growing tensions in Europe and Asia created a serious conflict for Americans during the 1930s. Most Americans opposed the fascist or military leaders gaining control in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other countries. But they were not willing to take any firm action to stop this ugly and growing movement. Americans simply did not want to become involved in another world war. They called on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan would finally force Americans to choose between their love of democracy and their desire for peace.
The first challenge to America's policy of neutrality came in October 1935. Troops from fascist Italy invaded Ethiopia. Roosevelt did not feel neutral at all. He told his advisors, "Italy is dropping bombs on Ethiopia, and that is war." he sharply criticized the fascist Italian leader Benito Mussolini. Roosevelt issued an order banning Americans from sending arms to either Italy or Ethiopia, and he called on Americans not to send oil or other materials to Italy. Roosevelt's efforts to stop the export of oil and other products did not succeed. But the efforts by the White House played an important part in leading the League of Nations to take economic actions against Italy. Less than 2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. Spanish fascists led by General Francisco Franco tried to overthrow the democratic government in Madrid. Some Americans went to join the Democratic Army in Spain to fight Franco. But Roosevelt and the Congress agreed that America should remain officially neutral in the conflict. In this way, Roosevelt was meeting the wishes of the American people by avoiding war. But personally, he was deeply troubled by the events in Europe. In a letter to his ambassador in France, Roosevelt wrote, "One cannot help feeling that the whole European situation is blacker than at any time in your lifetime or mine." Another challenge to American neutrality came in Asia. Japan launched a new invasion of China in July 1937. Within 1 month, Japanese forces gained control of what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. The United States had long supported the nationalist forces of China, and many Americans were angry about the Japanese invasion. But Roosevelt and his administration once again refused to take strong actions against the aggression. For one thing, the American Navy was weak. There was little it could do to stop Japanese aggression thousands of miles away in Asia. And neither Roosevelt nor the Congress wanted to be the first to break America's official policy of neutrality. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in private talks with friends that he understood the serious threat to world peace created by Adolf Hitler and other fascists. He believed that the United States could not remain neutral forever if democracy was threatened in so many countries. However, Roosevelt did little to educate the nation about this threat. Instead, he generally followed the wishes of the majority of people who wanted America to remain neutral. Public opinion in the United States was strongly against any kind of involvement in foreign conflicts. In 1937, Roosevelt made an important speech calling for the world's neutral nations to protect themselves from lawless fascist nations. But many Americans feared that Roosevelt was trying to create a new alliance, and they opposed his efforts. A public opinion survey at the time showed that less than one in three Americans was willing to change the nation's strong neutrality laws to give Roosevelt more freedom of action. In the same year, Japanese planes sank an American gunboat in the Yangtze River in China. But few Americans showed any interest in going to war over the incident. Instead, they accepted Japanese apologies. Americans simply had no desire to fight. Most Americans honestly believed that the best hope for their country was neutrality. One of the most influential supporters of neutrality was Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. He told the New York Times in 1937 that there can be no objection to any action the government may take which tries to bring peace to the world. But that action, he added, must not tie the American people into another world death march. He said, "I very much fear that we are once again being caused to feel that the call is upon America to police a world that chooses to follow insane leaders. Adolf Hitler's Nazi forces moved into the Rhineland in 1936. 2 years later, they invaded Austria. And then, in the following months, Hitler began making demands on the government of Czechoslovakia. Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was afraid that Hitler might start a general European war if he was blocked from gaining control of Czechoslovakia. In September of 1938, Chamberlain traveled to Munich to discuss the situation with the German leader. The result was that Britain agreed to a German takeover of Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain returned to London, promising peace in our time.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. The German Führer and Chancellor and the British Prime Minister have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The first reaction of most Americans to Chamberlain's Munich agreement was one of relief. But then public opinion changed. Americans saw that Hitler's Germany now had control of Central Europe. Japan was becoming more powerful in Asia. Chamberlain's weakness only served to show dictators that they could gain land and power through aggression and fear. Roosevelt warned Americans in late 1938 about this fascist threat. "There can be no peace," he said, "if another nation makes the threat of war its national policy."
There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the threat of war. There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the dispersion all over the world of millions of helpless and persecuted wanderers with no place to lay their heads. There can be no peace if humble men and women are not free to think their own thoughts, to express their own feelings, and to worship God. There can be no peace if economic resources that ought to be devoted to social and economic reconstruction are to be diverted to an intensified competition in armaments.
Roosevelt and much of the American public continued to hope that the United States could stay out of foreign conflicts. But increasingly they understood that war might come, and they began to prepare for possible hostilities. Following the Munich Agreement, Roosevelt requested a large increase in the defense budget. He asked Britain and France to buy arms from American manufacturers to give those companies more experience in producing weapons. And he helped bring about an agreement among nations in North and South America to join together to oppose fascist threats to peace and security. Finally, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to change the neutrality laws. He wanted more freedom as president to resist fascist aggression and help Britain, France, China, and other friendly nations. Congress, however, continued to resist such changes. But events in early 1939 showed that war was on the way. Germany occupied Czechoslovakia and then Lithuania. Franco's forces took control in Spain. Italy invaded Albania. And then Hitler began making demands on Poland. In August, Germany and the Soviet Union announced to the world that they had signed a non-aggression agreement. A week later, Germany attacked Poland. Two days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany.
Germany's invasion of Poland and the beginning of the war presented a great challenge to the United States. On the one hand, almost all Americans supported the European democracies, opposing the aggression by Hitler, Mussolini, and other fascists. But on the other hand, Americans had no desire to fight in what many feared would be a long and bloody war. The following months would force Americans of all political beliefs to consider this problem. It would be a final period of peace for the United States before events once again drew it into a terrible world conflict. That will be our story tomorrow here on Learning English. That's right, tomorrow. Beginning this week, The Making of a Nation will be heard on Sundays and Mondays. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmel. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them both. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can also read, listen to, and download our other programs. And you will find captioned videos and lessons to test your American English skills. We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. You can also send us a message through our website. Please know that however you reach us, we do read every message you send. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour, Universal Time, every day of the year. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from The Voice of America.